when everything's a priority, nothing is a priority. So we have to start with understanding truly what first things first looks like. Our ability to do that impacts us not only in disruption, but it also can inform and help us on a day-to-day basis.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the HIP Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Duby, Principal Technologist Americas at Semperis. Organizations, particularly IT and information security staff, have been on a journey not of their own choosing over the last 10 years. This is the journey from what's an attack to we might be attacked. Do we have a disaster recovery plan somewhere? To we will be attacked. Do we have a crisis management team in plan? To we're under attack, but how do we keep the business running? And it's been a continual, stressful game of catch-up ever since. This is where the topic of organizational and cyber resilience comes in. How do you, in the words of my guest today, make things less bad than they might have been otherwise? And my guest today is Heather Costa, a leading authority in cyber and technology resilience, currently serving as the Director of Technology Resilience at Mayo Clinic. With over 20 years of experience, she's shaped resilience programs at premier healthcare institutions, notably pioneering business resilience at Cleveland Clinic before architecting Mayo Clinic's enterprise-wide recovery and continuity initiatives. Heather's frequently invited to share her insights at organizations and conferences, such as Harvard National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, the Healthcare Information and Management Systems Society, and the HIPAA Summit. She's recognized for building high-performing teams and fostering the next generation of cybersecurity leaders. And I should say, if you aren't familiar with Mayo, it's one of the leading healthcare education and research medical centers in the U.S. It employs over 7,300 physicians and scientists and has a top-rated medical school. And it spends more than $660 million yearly on research and has more than 3,000 full-time research personnel. I have a personal connection to Mayo. Back when I was a teenager, I had surgery at their home location in Rochester, Minnesota, as a teenager to correct a crossbite. And let me tell you, having your jaw wired shut for 6 weeks in your senior summer was a memorable experience. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you, Sean. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you said that Mayo, before a call, that Mayo is actually an international organization. Is that right?
Yes, Mayo is. So Mayo employs over 85,000 people. We are worldwide in over 140 countries. In the U.S., we have main sites in Rochester, Minnesota, as you mentioned, Scottsdale and Phoenix, Arizona, and Jacksonville, Florida, as well as a number of hospitals and clinics up in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, in sort of that region of the country.
So a very influential healthcare organization in what you do and what you build and what you publish.
Absolutely. Mayo is the best of the best. One of one is a phrase we often use here. And the work that we do is impactful to many, many people. We see over 1 million patients a year. And a lot of the patients that are treated at Mayo facilities are high acuity patients, patients with complex medical journeys, sometimes seeking challenging from a diagnostic perspective, seeking to understand what's going on with them. I get the privilege of hearing from patients and families of those that have received care from Mayo Clinic, and they talk about Mayo having saved the lives of their family members or sometimes them through correcting a misdiagnosis or treatment that was cutting edge treatment that was only available at Mayo after seeking, you know, second and third opinions. And so it really is a special place, and I'm privileged to be able to work here and do the work that we do because I know this work matters.
Well, especially in terms of this topic, is very impactful. So Let's start with the basics and let's assume that our audience has been hearing the topic of resilience popping up more and more, but they don't necessarily understand what it is. And the basic Merriam-Webster definition that we all understand is the capacity to withstand or recover quickly from difficulties or toughness. Now, I've heard a definition of cyber resiliency as the ability to anticipate, withstand, recover from, and adapt to adverse conditions, stresses, attacks, or compromises on systems that use or are enabled by cyber resources. What's your definition of resilience as you lead it at Mayo, and how it, especially in the healthcare sector, the healthcare variant of this?
So I think it's a combination of the dictionary definition, a little bit of the cyber definition that you provided, and I'd go a step further. Yes, we work to make things less bad. We also are working to make things better on the other side. My youngest son, I'm a mom of four. I have four children. My youngest son, Caleb, came to me several years ago, excited about tardigrades. He had watched something and he learned about tardigrades, which are these microscopic creatures that have survived all five extinctions and for over 600 million years and all of these different, whether it's ice or lava or outer space, they've been irradiated, all of these various things, they survive. And so that's when it occurred to me that that really is what we should be doing in our organizations. At that time, I was working at Cleveland Clinic, building the resiliency program there. And I said to my team, we have a new mascot. And they're like, this thing is ugly, Heather. What is this thing? What are you talking about? I'm like, yes, but it doesn't matter because this is resilience. And for me, it means not just recovering, but being better, adapting, where we're wired in our DNA organizationally to thrive in disruption, not just survive.
So you expect disruption.
Yes.
And then and you anticipate disruption and then learn to thrive on top of that.
Yes, that's the goal. Now, it's a journey. Nobody just arrives there straight out of the gate. And it certainly has been a learning process for me over the last couple of decades now to move through learning about what resilience is, how we can do it better, how we can wire our organizations for resilience, and then the process of moving the needle to do so. It's an incremental process. There's no perfection in this work. We're on a journey.
Right. Okay. So as you say, as on a journey, so if, again, as our audience is looking at this and we're explaining what resilience is at a high level, if you need to sell this concept of resilience to your organization, assuming they're unfamiliar with it as well, you have to be able to explain it in terms of business benefit, mm-hmm. ideally with examples. So what might be an example, could be a real example, could be a theoretical example of resilience in healthcare, in a healthcare.
So in a sort of a non-cybersecurity setting, we saw resilience at its best, I think, during COVID, right? That impacted healthcare organizations in ways that we did not imagine. We cannot always know the disruption, but we can understand what the consequences are for a disruption. So if we understand, if we're disrupted, this is what that looks like to our patients. This is where it would interfere with our ability to deliver safe and effective care for our patients. And how can we ensure that we can do that even in the disruption? So that really is the question that we're answering.
So you would say, sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
So you would say, we don't know what happened. We don't actually, or perhaps you're saying, we don't care what's happened. We just know that these systems are unavailable and we have to continue treating patients.
Systems, and we have to have people, a process. For that? Well, and you hit on it, right? So it's not about the technology per se, right? Technology is an enabler. There are three things that we need in this particular order, we need people and then process, and then we need technology to enable that. So it's Brian Spisak, who is he's with the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. He says leadership first, technology last. And that's the exact right approach. So it's understanding, what do we do as an organization, the overarching mission of the organization, and then what do we need in order to accomplish that? And what does that prioritization look like? That's the first big question that we have to answer. When, you know, we've all heard it, when everything's a priority, nothing is a priority. So we have to start with understanding truly what first things first looks like. Our ability to do that impacts us not only in disruption, but it impacts in major disruption or crisis like a cyber attack, but it also can inform and help us on a day-to-day basis. There are disruptions every day. The server patch caused a conflict and now this is not working the way that it normally would. There's been a flood, a fire, a hurricane, something that we can't control, but that comes our way, and we know that it's going to impact how our employees can arrive at work. Can our caregivers get to work? When they get there, is the power on? Will the medical equipment work? You know, is the building flooded? Is the building safe for our patients? So these are the kind of questions and the kind of things that we're faced with constantly. But if you look at each one of those scenarios of disruption, the output is the same. The way that it impacts our ability to care for patients is the same, what those impacts are. Do we have staff that's going to be able to care for our patients? If we don't have staff, we can't provide care to our patients. So the ultimate sort of outcome is not being able to provide care. So then we have to work backwards from that and say, okay, what can we do in order to put some scaffolding in place, some process in place, the right people in place to lead us through that? And how are we better for it? When we build resilience, technology resilience in a scalable way, it can serve us for those everyday small disruptions or medium-sized disruptions or larger scale disruptions. And that really is the key to sort of selling it and creating that ROI. Everyone can point to the experience that they've had when the alert goes out, oh, this system isn't working. Or with COVID, when the alert went out, we didn't have enough staff because we had staff getting sick. We didn't have enough ventilators because there was this rush and need for ventilators. When Hurricane Maria happened, we didn't have enough saline because the saline production had been interrupted. So we know what the consequences look like. So how can we plan for those and make it, as you mentioned early on, less bad?
So what you're saying is start with first principles. What is the business here for? What is the mission of the business? And use that as a guiding light for the steps that you should be taking?
Yes, absolutely. Everyone will tell you that the thing they do is the most important thing. And it is. It is. If you asked someone, historically, and when we've looked at disaster recovery and business impact analysis, has actually more been application impact analysis, where we go, tell me all your critical applications. And if I say that to a doctor is going to tell me one thing. If I say that to, a lab technician, they're going to tell me something else. If I say that to rev cycle or financial person, they're going to tell me something else. And that's their perspective. And it's not wrong. And for them, those are the important things, the critical things that they need in order to do their work. You have to come up a level. And the larger question is, what do we need to maintain the mission of the organization? All of those things drive and feed that mission, but there becomes sort of that hierarchy of need. We all know about Maslow's hierarchy, or most people do, right? You have to take care of the basic needs first. And the idea of this really isn't any different.
When you look at it with that perspective and you look at it starting with the higher mission, how do you take the next steps then to say, well, the mission of this company is to keep making widgets layered on the three-leg tripod of people, process, and technology, and with people as most important, if somebody had to start taking steps towards cyber resilience, the logical thing for a technologist, because we're technologists and we like playing with technology, is the logical thing is to start throwing technology at it. But in terms of starting resilience, do you start by, I don't know what, do you, in terms of people, for example, what do you do? I'm sorry?
I never start with technology.
That's what I'm getting at. And it shows where I'm not doing so great in terms of what do you do in terms of, you don't start with technology, you start with people, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. What do you do? How do you first start talking to management about, hey, you're focused on this stuff. What we really need to do is be focused on this stuff.
So I think it becomes a sort of a dance, right? You're listening more than you're talking. And you meet people where they are. So the first question I always ask is, tell me what you do. What do you do for the organization? I don't start with tell me the technologies that you use and what are important, right? So when I'm thinking about a business impact analysis, my first question is, what do you do? Bucket it into the top three or five things that your department is responsible for. If you have to, you know, think 30,000 foot view, what are those buckets? And then I'm going to ask, what do you need in order to do those things? And when I'm asking what you need, I'm not asking what you need only from a technology perspective. I'm asking what you need from a staffing perspective, key third-party vendors, equipment, technology. I'm asking across all of those things so that I can get a comprehensive picture. And that really is the difference between disaster recovery, which is historically siloed and very IT-driven and focused, and integrated resilience strategy, where we're combining all of these things together. We're thinking about it in terms of the business and the operations. We're thinking about the cyber resilience and the technology resilience. So it becomes the marrying of all of those things. And then from there, I can back into, okay, here are the critical applications. Here are the critical third-party vendors. And then I can assess what I need to do to protect those in a meaningful way that I can recover them quickly. I have alternate, if it's a third-party vendor, I have an alternate pathway. Maybe I eliminate a single point of failure if I identify it. If it's a staffing issue, understanding that if the mission of the organization is X, and in order to do X, that means at a minimum, I've got to be able to do these six things. Normally, I do 12 things, so I'm going to wait on six of those things, and that frees up some staff that I might be able to redeploy into other ways to help support those six things in that time of crisis. So it becomes this sort of juggling and prioritization. We all do it. We do it every day in our life. We start with the things that are most critically important to us, and we work our way backwards. If you can't pay the mortgage, you're not going to go on vacation. So you start with, I'm going to pay the mortgage. And then after I paid the mortgage, I'm going to feed the family and, whatever those things are, I'm going to Maslow's law, right? I'm going to take care of those things first. And then when I see what's left, I'll go to the next thing. Maybe then I'll go on vacation. Everybody's fed and housed and clothed and happy. Now I'm going to go on vacation because I have the resource and capacity to do so. And that really is the same kind of conversation that we need to have inside of our organization. When we approach it from a technology perspective, if I say, tell me what applications are important to you, I'm going to end up with a list, and this happens across, I've seen it in multiple organizations. I worked in the banking and finance industry prior to coming into healthcare. You see it there too. And I've talked to other people in all manner of different industries and sectors about this work and sort of how they think about it and see it and do it. And like, oh, well, mission critical is 400 applications. Well, in a cyber incident, we'll never be able to recover those. It's not a sudden recovery, particularly if you're thinking about a full rebuild, bare metal rebuild, right? From the ground up, if I have to rebuild this technology environment because it's been compromised, because my data has been encrypted or stolen or both, if I have to do a full metal rebuild, then I have to take my time. The house isn't going to just magically appear, right? I got to pour the foundation and then I have to build the walls. And so that takes significantly more time. So when you have 120, 200, 300, 400 mission critical applications. If it takes me at least five times, which is what it would take me at least five times to recover that in a bare metal rebuild as it does from a restore from backup, then I'll never get done. I'll never get to recovery. So I have to be more narrow in my approach. I have to be more intentional and targeted in how I think about the work and what that looks like. And so we have to get these big ideas down to minimally viable. What does minimum viable look like? And how can we execute that first?
Boy, you are pointing to something that is typically not a strength of, I'll broadly say IT or crisis management, which is people skills, because there's a lot of psychology in what you're just talking about.
There is.
People are very technology focused. They're very, I need these applications. They have to have these applications. It's like, no, what is your, how do you fit into the mission? How do you abstract what you're using the application for towards the mission, which then, if you can make them think about that, you say, would pencil and paper work, or would passing it to the so-and-so work, or help making them think outside the box that they've been inside for 10 or 20 or plus years.
Well, and the environment, right? The emerging technologies, we just keep getting more and more interconnected into the technology. And it is deeply embedded in what we do every day. And so it does feel almost impossible to survive without it. And in some cases, we get situations where we're like, yeah, that we've got to figure something out because there isn't a manual process and this can't wait. But those are the big things that we need to put the attention on, not in trying to figure that out for everything that sort of brings comfort. And that is not an easy conversation to have. You're right about that. But again, a lot of it is listening and then sort of helping lead people through that process and thinking about the work in a different way. And it's usually pretty fascinating once you do. I've had hundreds of those conversations, as you can imagine. And there's this like sort of light bulb moment, this aha moment where people go, that makes so much sense. And then if we can start there, that we don't have to end there. That's the beauty of it, right? It's the process of continuous improvement. We're getting the nickels. So we start with minimally viable. We start with identifying what that is and what that looks like. And then we know what's next. We know what's first. We know what's second. We know what's third. Then we can move through that continuum to get back to a more productive and recovered state. And as we do it, we might be able to do things like eliminate tech debt, eliminate duplicative applications that are in the environment. Because when you're thinking about, I have to recover this entire environment in some cases, guess what? I'm not going to recover the things that we retired, but we just held on to as a safety blanket. So then that becomes an opportunity to sharpen our tool set and to be better, to be more narrowly focused on these are really the critical things and these are the things that we need to run our organization. There's a lot of technology bloat and data bloat that happens, particularly in healthcare. I imagine it happens in other industries too, where you just hold on to things because this is sort of the way we've always done it. And so that becomes an opportunity to challenge some of that status quo and how can we do it better?
It's very much a leadership challenge because you have to find a leader, sell them the concept and the understand of resilience. And they have the position, the people skills, the mission, the evangelism to drive this forward to an organization, because you really are changing the way people think.
I am. When I was in Cleveland, the CISO there said, after I took over leadership of the team and we redefined resilience at Cleveland Clinic, the CISO said, Heather, you completely changed the conversation of resilience at the Cleveland Clinic. And I said, I had to, because you were having the wrong conversation.
And it's sort of in that spectrum that I described in the introduction. You know, people are going into then I think most organizations are in the crisis management aspect of it. Okay, we now have a crisis management team with plans and all that. And it is not entirely, certainly, but largely still technology focused. There's communications and there's legal and, you know, there's some HR aspects of it, but it all is technology is underpinning it. And as you say, this is, and there's a parallel in that in crisis management, one of the challenges is making decisions in crisis. And there are plenty of organizations that just, and I know this from personal experience in talking to many people and it's their response. They're ready to go, but the organization can't make decisions. And this is the people part of people, process, and technology. So again, we're coming back to, hey, it's people in all of this.
It is. It's always people. It's always people. And part of that decision, you know, part of that decision-making process, when I can, there's decisions that I can make ahead of time. So that's part of that readiness and preparedness that can and should happen. If I know what the most important things are and I've identified that ahead of time, I don't have to do that in the moment. I don't have to sit there and sort of banter back and forth with the group to decide which thing is first. I know this is first, this is second, this is third. So that's part of the pre-work, if you will. It's much better to make those kinds of decisions in the calm than it is in the storm. So that's a starting point. So let's take those decisions that we know we're going to have to make, and let's make as much of them as we can ahead of time, with the understanding that we might have to be flexible in the moment. When we get there, the disruption may look different than what we planned. But if I plan from a worst case scenario perspective, then I can effectively pivot. If the scenario comes back, it's not as bad as I thought it would be, I'm able to pivot through that. However, if I plan with a bunch of assumptions that are, oh, well, we'll have this and we'll have the cloud and we'll have, you know, we'll have these sort of components here and there, and I'm going to assume that we can do da da da. And then I don't have any of those things that I thought about in assumption. It's a lot harder to pivot. So that's the other thing is that we talk about a lot is worst case scenario planning. You plan for the spig, but you do it in such a way that allows you to scale it down. So if I need to scale for something that's this big, I can do that. If I need to scale for something that's this big, I can do that. And then you also have a better value proposition. If the systems and the people, processes, and technology and systems that we put in place for the big major disruption can have a one-to-many benefit and are useful in those smaller disruptions that happen daily, now I've got a better value benefit, right? That I have, it's a better ROI story to my executive leaders and my team.
Because you have the same plan you have the same plan that you can use and just adjust the scale of it.
Right. And if I built a recovery environment, I can use that. I don't have to wait for the big catastrophic thing. If I built the recovery environment in a way that it's sort of multi-purpose, if you will.
Right.
It gives me a place where I can kind of do the work for the smaller thing here while they're figuring it out. And then it also is there for the larger. It doesn't just sit empty in the in-between times. Right. And that's meaningful when I have those conversations with my leadership teams. That means something. That's meaningful.
Here's You're one using it more.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you plan and build a resilience capability that will stand up to the next bad thing? I mean, the idea of you've gone through and you've built this resilience capability, but it has to be, you don't want to have to rework it 6 months from now, something like that. How do you take that into account?
Yeah. So I think a few things are true. I do what I call blue sky strategy planning. And I've done that with all of my teams. And literally it's kind of what it sounds like. What does this look like if there were no barriers? What would it look like? What does platinum, diamond encrusted resilience look like for our organization?
Money were no object.
There are no barriers, right? It's a blue sky. There are no barriers for existing process or people kind of, well, we've never done it that way before. There's no barriers of resourcing or, you know, monetary or otherwise. If there are no barriers, this is what it looks like. This is a very high level idea. And it runs counter to a lot of traditional IT thinking, which tends to be fairly tactical in nature. So I'm a strategist. I did not start my career in IT. In fact, I didn't work in IT until I came to Cleveland Clinic. So I have a lot of experience in other sort of parts of organizations and thinking about things slightly differently than some others might. And my brain is very strategic. It's my superpower. So I start with that. And now I have a desired end state. I'm not backing myself into a corner based on the constraints and the things that are happening today. I'm looking at this really high level sort of utopian sort of idea of what resilience needs to be. Brainstorming process, bucket those things into big categories, and then you go, okay, now this is where I want to go. Now I'm listening. Where are we? What are the pain points? What are the things we're most concerned about? What is the threat environment looking like today? Where is there potentially low-hanging fruit? What are the highest risk things that I can start to address? When you get in your car and you set your GPS, there are two things you need. This is where I am and this is where I'm going in order to chart that path. And that really is what this is. This is about charting a path. You get agreement and buy-in that this is where we want to go. We may never arrive. We may never arrive because we know that unlike the blue sky, there are constraints. But we have this North Star. This becomes our guiding light of where we want to go. Now I know where we are, and now I can incrementally move that needle. That's why it's about continuous improvement. It's a game of increments. I have to talk about getting the nickel. Nickels will get you quarters, and quarters will get you dollars, or two nickels will get you a first down in football, if you're a football fan, right? It's a game of increments. So I know where I want to go, ideally. I understand now where I am. And now I'm going to take this risk-based approach to move the needle. If I'm very clear, if everyone is very clear on that desired state objective and in agreement, then we can make sure that all the things we're doing move us closer. And because it is forward thinking and sort of utopian in the idea, you're not building something in a way that's going to kind of build you into a corner. It also requires staying up on the latest changes in the threat environment, what's happening, you know, from a cybersecurity perspective, what's happening in the cybersecurity space, what's happening from the standpoint of emerging technologies, what are the risks and threats that that introduces, as well as what are the benefits and how can we leverage some of those things to help us on our journey to that desired end state objective, having very measurable goals. This is not just, oh, well, this is an idea floating out here. There are milestones and measurements and markers that we can utilize to validate that we are making progress. We are moving forward resilience in our organizations, aligning those with industry standard best practices and things like the NIST framework and high trust and those sorts of things are important. But the other piece of it that we can't lose sight of is it doesn't matter if it doesn't matter for our organization. So it's not a cookie cutter approach. You get a lot of the big consulting firms come in and they have this approach that has been used in finance and they just want to kind of roll out this cookie cutter approach because this is what we've always done. And it isn't sensitive to the culture of the organization and sometimes not sensitive to the regulatory requirements when you're looking across industry. And so it's critically important that we're thinking about all of those things. If it doesn't work for us, it doesn't work, period. No matter how good the idea is.
Right, right. And that also informs the inevitable budget questions where we only have so much budget, but if you can point it back to the mission of the organization and how it moves the mission of the organization forward, or how it keeps the mission going in the face of adversity, then that's the sort of thing that business leaders can understand.
Yep.
As we're sort of wrapping things up here just a little bit, what don't people seem to understand when they begin planning or incorporating resilience into their organization? I think we've talked about that, but it's kind of good just to be clear.
I think the first question that always is sort of can be a stumbling block is what's first? Okay. What's first? When I think about it in terms of operationally, I need to know this is the first department I need to focus on getting back online, because this is the first department that will help ensure my ability to meet the mission of the organization. And then I need to know at a minimum what that department needs in order to be viable. And that's where I start. That way, I'm sure that when I have my list of applications, I'm starting with 1, 2, 3, that kind of granular sort of ordinal approach to recovery is not something that has ever been done really in this work when we think about it from a disaster recovery perspective. And so historically, traditionally what you end up with is, I've got 150 applications that have to be recovered, do them in whatever order, and you just start throwing darts at the board. The problem with that is, if I have not connected the dot and aligned it back to business and operational perspective, clinical perspective, then I might be recovering 1 for podiatry and 2 for the ED and 1 for nursing. And I have no idea whether I'm connecting the dots and whether I am bringing back online those most critical areas in a way that makes them at least minimally viable. And that really is one of the first big things is having a very solid data-informed impact, business impact analysis. And I underscore the word business because really it is a departure from traditional application impact analysis where someone is saying these applications are critical to me.
Yeah, as they, you know, when you work in IT, you think IT is the most important thing, where it's just about supporting the business. And the mission of the organization. So what final advice would you give our audience? What kind of a takeaway would you give from our conversation to say what should they start looking at this week?
So I think you hit it right. You have to start. Don't wait for it to be perfect. It will never be perfect. You have to start. And start by listening. Understand what's happening in your organization. Understand what's the thing you can galvanize around, that you can galvanize the team around. Here at Mayo, the mission is very clear. The needs of the patient come first. And so when that's the center of everything, it's not hard to have those conversations about what we need to be doing and how we need to be doing it. So what's that thing you can galvanize around? And then just start somewhere. Put one foot in front of the other. Have a very clear stated, this is where we want to go. This is where we'd love to land, right? In this utopian idea of resilience. And this is where we are. So once you can figure those two things out, which don't largely take money, they will take some time, but it's not a terribly, the listening takes the longest. Building out the desired state objective, it's not really a long drawn out process. It can be done fairly quickly. And then you start shopping that around as you're listening. And that really, that listening process becomes the longest. But that's I guess that's the message, right? Those things don't require a lot of money. It doesn't require special technology to start to connect and build those relationships, because people are the starting point.
It involves talking to people and understanding, building the roadmap based on what you learn from your conversations around the business and, again, the people.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. Well, this has been
and
great.
I know sometimes people are like, but I have so much, like, we need to hurry up. We need to hurry up. But running in circles doesn't get you to where you're going faster than if you take a pause and start running in a straight line.
Well, and it's, you know, working with people versus working with challenge, working with technology is, it's an entirely different challenge. And it's, as we all know, working in IT, it's not the same skill set.
It's not. But when you articulate the problem, then you're halfway to the solution. Kidlin's law, right? If you start with the clear articulation of the problem,
right,
then you can figure out the solution.
Awesome. Thanks, Heather. This was great.
Thanks, Sean.
I really enjoyed it. I'm going to make sure all my friends listen to it as well.
Great. Me too.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for watching our HIP podcast with Heather Costa today. If you enjoyed this, please subscribe. Send it to your friends. We're sponsored by Semperis. Thanks again.